from the Netherlands, this is the Green Planet Monitor, voices and stories from a warm, wet planet.
I've heard stories of people whose grandparents were shot, of people whose houses were taken, of people who don't have access to water.
And when people actually understand this, that you're saving maybe over 50% of the energy and 60% of the water in a building, the coin drops. You can see it in their eyes. You go, damn. You know, why haven't we done this before? This is so logical.
Today, young Israelis who refuse to serve in the military, they've got a problem with permanent military occupation and apartheid. And as climate catastrophe sweeps the planet, in the Swedish city of Göteborg, engineers and students are designing the sort of building where people can live comfortably without squandering Earth's limited resources or polluting its atmosphere. In most countries, being a soldier is something you do if your country is at war, or if you like following orders, carrying a gun and shooting people on command. Military service is typically something young people avoid. Not so in Israel. The Israeli Defense Forces, the IDF, is Israel's most beloved national institution. Obligatory conscription at the age of 18 is a rite of passage, a sacred duty to look forward to and embrace with pride. Not for everyone, however. Horrified by their country's permanent military occupation of the Palestinian West Bank and its apartheid-style subjugation of the Palestinian people, a small but increasing number of young people are refusing. This past summer, I spoke with two young resistors. Both are members of the anti-occupation network Mesarvot. Noam Aharoni is 18 and has just been granted conscientious objector status. Ayelet is 16, but is gearing up well in advance to say no. Last May, on Pride Day, Ayelet got detained for carrying a sign that read, "No Pride in the Occupation," and a Palestinian flag. I spoke with Noam and Ayelet in a park in Tel Aviv. Lots of birds over our heads. They do quiet down.
My name is Noam Aharoni. I am an 18-year-old Israeli living in Tel Aviv, and I'm currently in the process of refusing to serve in the IDF.
Which is the Israeli Defense Force.
Which is the Israeli Defense Force, yes. It's the Israeli military. It is mandatory for every Israeli citizen to serve at around the age of 18 or 19, depending on whether or not you participate in a gap year program. And I currently am refusing for a myriad of reasons that I'm sure will come up.
My name is Ayelet. My pronouns are they, them, and I am a 16-year-old Israeli. I am currently in high school. I participate in several protest organizations that, among other obviously very important goals, are there to protest the Israeli occupation of Palestine. And I have obviously yet to refuse to join the military because the draft only comes when you're 18, but I intend to refuse.
The IDF, the Israeli Army, is an institution in Israel. I gather that I've read that it's the most revered and respected institutions in Israeli society. I mean, Israeli soldiers, young men and young women, are the children,
yeah,
the sons and the daughters of Israel. Talk about this. Talk about what the IDF and the Israeli military is and represents in Israeli society.
In my opinion, one of the most fascinating things about the role the IDF plays in Israeli society is how it's integrated into the modern consensus. And you said this term that the IDF is our children, and I'm not surprised you've heard it, because this is something you'll hear in most discussions. Basically, the IDF has been able to integrate itself into common discourse in a way where it's just another thing you do. It's become absolutely unquestionable, both on a moral and a practical level. the mythos surrounding the IDF is that it's the only thing that's keeping Israel in existence, and that everyone does it. It's not even a rite of passage, it's just a basic fact of life.
Joining the IDF is as ubiquitous as going to primary school.
Yeah.
It's just not the not to do it. If you didn't go to primary school, something was wrong. It's the same thing here. It's true that there's an idea that you must have the IDF to protect the existence of Israel, but even more than that, it's not even just the military force in the way it's conceived. It's so entrenched in Israeli culture that regardless of if you're there, if you think you're there to be a soldier or not, you are going because it's just a facet of your existence that you have been raised to accept and know you will be going to since preschool.
But I mean, in Israel, everybody expects you to go into the military.
Yeah.
It's a mandatory military service. And that expectation is universal. Like, nobody questions the fact that you're going to do your mandatory military service.
Every single Israeli citizen has gone through the IDF and gone through the weird hazing that they have you do and gone through boot camp and all that stuff. And it's supposed to create a unifying experience, which is really stronger than any actual need for all the people in Israel to actually participate in the military. It is unnecessary for every single Israeli citizen to join the IDF. That's not necessary for defense. In fact, there are plenty jobs in the IDF that are, you know, kind of bullshit jobs. You know, the kind of jobs where you sit there all day and you file papers that don't matter and nobody cares about just because they want to give you something to do. There's an idea of the IDF as the unifying experience that you have to do. And that's really the main goal of it, to give everyone a shared understanding of each other, for everyone to be able to see each other as kind of comrades. If everyone goes through this, everyone has gone through this really weird unifying experience, and it creates a very, very strong core of like national identity. That's why I think there's such a big idea of everyone needs to join the IDF, even though by this point they kind of have a bit too many people.
Politicians and high-ranking military officials, everyone who has actual power somewhere in the system, they can use a unified national identity in order to make the populace do and say whatever they want.
Noam, tell me about the thinking process that's gone into your decision to not to serve, and how does one go about not serving in the IDF? And tell me how you kind of have gotten to this point. You are 18 years old?
I am 18 years old, yes. I will be 19 in a few months. There are 5 main ways to get out of the army. You can get out on a mental exemption, on a physical exemption, if you're religious or a married woman. And then there are 2 other ways, which are the main 2 ways that our organization, Meservot, specializes in. You can either try and get conscientious objector status, which is saying, I'm a pacifist or I'm an anarchist. And you have to stand in front of a council called the Moral Compass Council and plead your case as to why you cannot serve in any military in the world, ideologically. At which point they might give you conscientious objector status, at which point you're free of army service, or they will say no. And the 5th way, which is what I'm probably going to have to do because conscientious objector status is rarely given, and I very much do not sugarcoat my beliefs, which is something that's usually necessary to get it, I'm probably going to refuse army service on the 24th of August and spend some time in military prison. Which, how that works is they put you in for about 7 to 10 days the first time. They take you out. They tell you to come join the military tomorrow, and you can either come tomorrow and refuse again and be put in for about 20 days, or stay at home until they come and get you after a week or so and go into military prison for 30 days that time. And this process repeats anywhere between 2 and 6 times.
So how did you reach this point where you decided you're going to be a resistor?
Well, I went to the school where I spent time living with Palestinians. My roommates were Palestinian for the most part. My classmates, a lot of them were Palestinian. It was 20% Palestinians, 20% Israelis, and 60% internationals.
And this was in Tel Aviv?
Yes, in Ramat HaSharon. And I actually got to contact them. I have been not wanting to join the military for personal reasons, just because it sounded like not fun since I was in first grade. But actually, yeah, no.
That's fair.
It's like they scream at you a bunch and they tell you to do a bunch of weird, like, obtuse stuff. And you do so many rituals that are just presenting this kind of imaginary backbone of the country. And you have to walk in certain ways. And it all felt meaningless. And it is, but...
But go back for a second. Yes. So you were in the school with... A lot of Palestinians. Tell me about that.
Well,
and what you learned from befriending and hanging out with Palestinians that led you to decide you weren't going to serve.
Basically, when you live with them, when you actually have to engage with them on a day-to-day basis, you see beyond the fact that I think an Israeli teenager has far more in common with a Palestinian teenager than they do with any Israeli politician. These people and the experiences they've had are not something that a person can just ignore without having to compartmentalize. I have...
And some of them, you became friends with some Palestinians.
Most of my best friends there were Palestinians. And I've heard stories of people whose grandparents were shot, of people whose houses were taken, of people who don't have access to water. I've gone to Bethlehem and visited their homes. I've been in East Jerusalem. I've been in Arab villages all across the country. And the more I learned in reading as well and from talking to Palestinian people and hearing their experiences, the more I realized that beyond the fact that there is absolutely no way that I can allow myself to serve in the IDF in any capacity, I have to refuse. I have to do something active because there's nothing else compared to this in my life that I can make this much of a difference, and I have to take this opportunity. And if I can use this to get any sort of media attention or just in order to plead my case in front of the military councils, this is something that I think I'm morally obligated to do, knowing what I know.
And Ayelet, you're 16, you know, you've not yet reached that point where you actually have to make the leap. But what is it that led you to decide you were going to refuse to serve?
Facts are just ignored in such a way that it is built to make you feel insane for pointing out things that are objectively happening. Every so often I try to talk with my classmates about, you know, what's happening, politics, whatever. And I'd mention something that Israel is objectively doing, for example, the way it bombs houses in the Gaza Strip. And they just look me in the eyes and tell me, that isn't happening. And everyone I'm talking to just looks at me and says, that's absolutely not happening. What the fuck are you talking about? Israeli media purposefully does not report on this.
Any piece of journalism that's not Israeli is anti-Semitic. Every single organization that criticizes Israel is anti-Semitic.
Exactly. And God forbid, they're not going to read a Palestinian source. What are they, terrorists? So as a result, you have this kind of a bubble in which they pretend that things that objectively are happening, that there's video evidence of is happening, just isn't happening. It's such a built-in narrative that's so difficult to escape from that it's just completely unheard of to question it.
What do you learn about in high school, Ayelet, about the occupation?
Well, okay, I learn in the middle of Tel Aviv, which is a very liberal area compared to everywhere else. So I have the advantages of some of my teachers kind of being against the occupation. That is absolutely not fit in with, like, the experience of most Israeli students, and it's definitely not fit in with the school syllabus. I remember what a teacher I really appreciate, I think a year ago, he decided to give us a lesson on the siege of Jaffa which is a country that eventually became incorporated into Tel Aviv. It's Tel Aviv Yafo now. And so I remember for one time, for a brief 45 minutes, he gave us a text that broke down that what happened. And it was an absolutely unheard of experience. The idea of just a teacher even just questioning something the IDF did is just completely unheard of.
And this was they were talking about the ethnic cleansing of Yafa.
Yes, they were explaining how the popular narrative in Israel, especially by teachers of what's known as the Nakba, is that actually they all saw Israel, like the Zionists, winning, and they decided they didn't want to live in a country with the Jewish people, so they fled. That's the narrative we're taught. In fact, in specific circumstances, for example, on Independence Day, which commemorates the Israeli, exactly, the 1948 Israeli-Arab War. It is, in fact, on that specific day, obviously, they explained to us, oh, guys, we fought and won our independence and all that. And it is actually illegal on that day to say the word the Nakba in class. Like, it's illegal for them to mention it. So that's just an example of the way it is. It's just, it's not mentioned. And when it is, it's purposefully either to lie or to twist the truth so far that it is a lie, to make it seem like everything Israel does is completely and inherently justified.
So can you remember the moment, the instant, when you decided, I'm not going to serve, I'm not going to do it?
I mean, which one? It's not really, at least in my experience, not a thing that you just decide. I can tell you, for example, from my school, that many of my Israeli classmates, even ones that were very close to Palestinians, ended up serving, and many of them considered not serving or even decided not to serve at some point. I can tell you that I have flip-flopped many, many times, because choosing not to serve, it's not like choosing not to take a job. It's choosing to actively put yourself at odds with the Israeli narrative. On every single level, you are no longer allowed to be a standard Israeli citizen. Even though there are anti-discrimination laws in job interviews, they're not allowed, for example, to ask you what you did in the military. You can only choose to mention it. But if you don't mention it, they're gonna notice that you didn't mention it.
Especially if, as you plan to refuse upon arrival and do so very publicly, you're going to be at the news stories.
Yeah.
So for you, when you come to a job interview, and someone's going to like do a basic background check, Google your name, check if you have a criminal record, that stuff is going to show up, and it's extremely impactful for how you get employed and other such things of living here in the future. It's not a one-off decision. It's a continuous decision where you decide every day that this is the narrative you will be in the rest of your life.
It's so often the case in our lives that we, you know, we're now entrenched in something and we're right on that path, but it's hard to establish the point when suddenly the light went on.
I have such a point.
Tell me about that.
Some time ago, I was with my family in Nazareth. This was actually around Christmas. Nazareth is obviously one of, like, in Israel, it's one of the only majority Christian places, and it's very Christian because it's Nazareth. And I was there, and it's a place that's mostly populated by Palestinians. And I was there, and there was, you know, all the fun Christmas things. There was this in the town square, there was this very large Christmas tree that was obviously there as a tourist attraction because the people there don't celebrate Christmas in the same way. But I saw a guy, maybe a Palestinian guy, maybe around my age, maybe a bit older. And for around 5 seconds, he stood there and waved the Palestinian flag in this tourist flooded town square. Everyone's looking at this massive Christmas tree. It's a tourist-flooded town square. Lots of people from all around the world, because it's Nazareth, obviously, and it's Christmas. And The military police of the West Bank had been swarming the place earlier, and also, of course, regular soldiers. And the moment he unfurled that flag, he was tackled to the ground and dragged away. And a woman who was with him, I don't know who she was, I don't know their relation, but she just looked after him and screamed for him as he got dragged away by this military police. And I was there with my family as a tourist, and I just froze.
Like, how old were you?
I was 15, something like that. I, like, looking back to it, there's, like, tons of things I know I should have done. Like, first of all, record it, you know, try to get people to notice. But I just froze. I just stood there and froze, taking someone for holding a flag. And, like, at that moment, I decided I couldn't do this. At the end of the day, I knew there was no way for me to join into a system that did that.
Whenever you try to criticize the IDF, you'll find this classic series of obstructions where you say, oh, I have a problem with the IDF. And they say, no, the IDF is, let's say theoretically, the most extreme. The IDF is a perfect organization. There's absolutely nothing wrong with it. So you present some things and they say...
The most moral military in the world.
Exactly. The most ethical military. And they
we
say...
We hear that line all the time.
Yeah. And...
Who says that?
It's a slogan. Like, it's a classic slogan. You can see it. Like, a lot of politicians use it, the most ethical military. They said because in...
Purity of arms.
They said because in Gaza, sometimes they...
have a roof-knocking protocol in which they send in a bunch of notes onto a building saying we're going to blow it up before they blow it up. But they only do it like 5 minutes ahead of time, and it doesn't allow people to get out before it blows up.
So have you guys talked to your friends about this over the years that you've been arriving at your decision? Did you talk this over with friends? Did you talk to...
Yeah. I found that probably within both my friends and my family are some of the people I've had the largest impact on. I remember the first time I decided not to serve, I think, was in 11th grade. I told all my friends during a Christmas, winter break dinner. I think it was New Year's, yeah. And they were all shocked, and some of them were like, oh, all right. Some of them were trying to encourage me to join the military anyway. But that was about the mix of opinions, a mix of acceptance and rejection, but a kind of acceptance. Like, none of them were going to stop being my friends or something.
And had you come across anybody else who resisted, who had resisted?
I've created a few. I know that. I know that of the around 8 friends that I had there that night, every single one of them was planning to join the military. And at this point, about 2 or 3 of them have gone out, and another 2 are considering it.
Is Israel an apartheid state?
Yes. Listen, I don't know how anyone tries to fight it, because you can't make both the claim that Israel is not an apartheid state and that Israel's involvement in the West Bank is somehow legitimate at the same time, because what's happening there is... a classic system of apartheid.
The occupied territories are part of Israel in all ways. And ergo, that means that Israel is an apartheid state by definition, because half of it, all of the occupied territories, are under an apartheid regime.
So Ayelet, I was asking Noam about whether he's talked about his decision with his friends. Have you talked about your own decision with your friends? And
yes.
So what do they say?
I have a very interesting split with my friends. If I were to go into my class and say, I think Israel is an apartheid state and it is inherently unjustified in existing, Zionism is an inherently poisonous ideology, and I'm not going to join the IDF, then someone would beat me up. Because I mentioned once in a lesson one negative thing I find about the IDF, not in an all-encompassing way, one negative thing, and I was like followed for 2 weeks by people showing up and at every time point asking me, hey, what do you think about the IDF? Do you happen to not support the IDF? Do you happen to be a traitor?
What did you say about the IDF?
Then I mentioned the IDF's protocol of being able to imprison people without trial indefinitely, Palestinians, I mentioned this in a negative way as an example of how, like, even in liberal democracies, there are still such tactics used to, like, erode our rights. So I mentioned this, and it was not taken well. But on the other hand, it's truly an amazing culture shock as I navigate between just different classes on our school. Because I also take, like, philosophy as an elective. That was also the class in which the teacher showed us a text about the siege of Jaffa. And there, if I say something like that, nobody blinks. Someone might say, "Oh, I kind of disagree." No, but nobody blinks. Nobody cares. It might not be like accepted as complete truth by everyone, but it is far more accepted than like other classes. So as a result, I kind of have a split in my friend groups, in which I have like newer friends, which are like from those kinds of classes, which oftentimes they're just very in line with what I say. Like I talk about it and they build on me and it's great, and a lot of them intend on refusing. And then I move, and then my friends from other classes, my friends maybe from like middle school and stuff like that, I talk to them like that and they look like I came from space.
Where are young people at politically in their heads in Israel today?
They are not.
That's not true.
No, it is. Listen, there is a growing amount of political engagement, but so much of Israel's power within Israel itself is entirely based on political disengagement. We have...
They're very engaged, but with the smoke and mirrors.
What do you mean, political disengagement?
What I mean is that beyond the fact that Israel's right-left is a fabrication, like as left as you can go in Israel is the center, but you also like gays and you want them to be able to marry. That's as left as you go in Israel. There's absolutely no sort of political thought or analysis within young people because that thing is actively discouraged. We have a very clear narrative that's been formulated for us, and people don't really want to question it to any degree. So there's no political engagement. What I mean by that basically is, if you talk to young people, they're not going to be able to tell you about policies. They're not going to be able to discuss theory with you, or political ideology, or any sort of something that's not simple acceptance or regurgitation of the status quo and its slogan. And I can tell you that because that's where I was up until two and a half years ago, when I had an extremely privileged and unique experience of going to an international school with Palestinians and international students.
But I wonder whether it's really any different anywhere else, like in Canada or in the United States. Kids your age, what the heck do they know? They don't know squat.
I think there's very much
analysis. Yeah. I mean, some do, but those that have a political analysis based on knowledge and thought, it's pretty rare. They don't know what's going on. They don't even know basic current events.
I think that's very much an international problem. I think that's part of the dominant ideology. We live in a world of neoliberalism, and the entire ideology is based on a kind of manufactured ignorance. People are, in every aspect of their life, actively discouraged from questioning the reality around them, because that's the moment it starts to topple. The moment you place a bit of weight on it, it blows up. And I mean, I can tell you, I've had these discussions with friends of mine around my age where those that are a bit more open to something outside of their realm of knowledge, you tell them things and they are legitimately shocked. I've been in that position. I've been in the position where people have told me stuff and it was just so outside of anything I was ever told that it blew my mind.
What? Like, for example?
The fact that Palestinians exist. I was never a denier of their existence. I was not, and those exist for some reason, but...
You're saying that some people...
I simply had no conception of them until I went to that school. I did not...
You're saying that some young people say, well, Palestinians don't exist?
Oh, a lot of people. That's a very common idea, like...
They're just Arabs.
Yeah.
Yes.
There is no Palestinian people.
Yeah. I was at a gap year program this year, and there was this girl there who, whenever I would say something about Palestinians, she'd say, Palestine doesn't exist. There's no Palestinian people. There's no Palestine. They made it up. They made it up after 1948 in order to fight against us. And, you know, those are lies, but people believe them. And it's exactly that kind of person that I think is an extreme form of the dominant ideology. And the dominant ideology is simply accepting the puppet theater that we have right now. Look at the elections. We have elections every 2 minutes. People have become disengaged because you are, by society, discouraged of following any sort of political activity that's not simply electoralism, that's not simply voting every 4 years, like...
Every four years, yes. Israel has a notoriously unstable political situation. I think in the past 5 years, we have had around 4 elections.
More.
And so, the young people, you know, your friends, I mean, maybe you come from a certain slice of Israeli youth who are different, like you guys are left to center, maybe even radical.
We come from a slice of Israelis that are privileged.
Yes.
And so your friends, would they, if they were to vote, and some of them do, would they vote for Netanyahu? Would they say, no?
We're going to vote for
Yair Lapid because he's so progressive.
I know a lot of people who aren't going to vote. That's the sad reality of it. And I don't blame them to a certain degree because voting feels meaningless. If your only form of political activity or engagement is voting, and you see what's going on here, where half the time your vote literally by definition does not matter because the government collapses before they can form a coalition, who can blame you for not caring anymore?
But these young people, when I think about, sometimes I hear that youth in Israel today are right wing. They're racist, they're fascist. I mean, these are just labels. But when you see the young people who gather in Jerusalem at the Damascus Gate for Jerusalem Day, maybe this is like a selection of young people that's really extreme. I hope that's not really representative of what young people are in Israel today. But when you look at those young people, and I'm sure there's not a tiny number of them.
Oh, it's scary.
I think
jumping up and down, and it's very tribal, and they're shouting death to Arabs. And
the thing about, in my opinion, politics in Israel is that there are, in order to operate on the political playing field in Israel, you need to fully accept Zionism as legitimate. That's it. That's the only opinions that are presented in any kind of like mainstream news. If you want to actually participate in politics in Israel, it's assumed that you agree with that. That's, in fact, it's assumed for every walk of life. For years, I knew the facts. I understood the idea that what Israel does is illegitimate. But I didn't for a moment think to question that inherent idea of Zionism, that we deserve to be here. That idea was so built into my brain that I didn't think that maybe it's possible that actually we don't deserve to be here. So I think it is accurate to say that a lot of the people in Israel are racist. I think most of them, because I think the way I see it, Zionism is an inherently racist ideology. And because of that, because almost everyone in Israel just blindly accepts Zionism because that's what they've, you know, been told all their lives, then, yeah, I do personally think that even if these theoretical people aren't voting for Netanyahu, even if they aren't, you know, shouting death to Arabs, I still think they're racist.
Does the future of Israel worry you? Are you worried about the future of Israel, Ayelet?
I'm worried about everything at all times, at all points in life. I mean, yes, of course it worries me.
I mean, we're all in trouble, right? Climate change.
Exactly.
I often say climate change, this place will be a furnace. It'll be baked dry before any solutions, political solutions are found. So it's a scary future. Yeah. But tell me about what your thoughts are about the future.
If I may. I think personally that the issue with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, or the Palestinian struggle, as I often prefer to call it when I can and remember to, is that's not a singular event. It's not something that's localized. It is the result of hundreds of years of colonialism and capitalist exploitation. Like, it's a Gordian knot of issues. And yeah. Right now, it seems that the future of Israel is the same future that we have everywhere else. A descent into fascism and global catastrophe and economic and climate catastrophe. Everything is crashing around us, everything is burning around us, and everyone is politically disengaged. We do, as we said earlier, have a growing far-right movement in Israel, and that's very concerning, especially because what we have is the center, or the status quo, is also right-wing. We don't have a center in Israel. But there is a growing amount of leftists in Israel. There's a growing amount of people actually willing to deal in any sort of questioning of the current hierarchical system. And it's slow, but honestly, as an optimist, I believe that it's going to be okay in the end. Like, in the end, the right people are going to win this. We're going to fix everything and survive this, and everything will be better. And that's very naive of me, but it's also the only thing that keeps me going, because otherwise, what's the point?
And do you see resistance, refusal to serve in the IDF as a kind of a tactic within a larger struggle, a pivotal act or a central act? Perhaps it's a strategic act.
I see it as
within a larger struggle, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, absolutely.
By the very presence of young people such as yourselves refusing to serve in the IDF and talking to others, that it's kind of an entrance way into profound change in Israel.
I think the more people that do that, that's the kind of political engagement that I hope to see. Because the more people that do that, the more people that will follow and do the same. Or even just get out of mental exemption. The more people that get out, the better.
But I mean, it brings us back to that question that I started with. Like, where does the IDF situate itself within Israeli society and culture? And
it is,
of course, it's the epicenter. It's a force of nature.
It's the IDF isn't people doing things. It's something that happens to you. It's just... It rains sometimes. It just like it rains sometimes, and you have no way of controlling if it rains or not. You join the IDF. That's it. It's just the path of life.
But it is also the state of Israel's arguably most central institution.
It's kind of like the way I see it in many ways. Think about how in many cultures, including this culture, marriage is like the end all be all for a lot of people, mostly women. Like the idea of a woman getting married to a man is, it's a must do. You at a certain point, a woman must go and marry a man and have children, and this is expected to be the epicenter of her life. I think in a lot of ways, the IDF takes on a very similar cultural role here, in which it's in the same way that in a lot of places, it's unthinkable for a woman to live her entire life without getting married and without having children. It's just unthinkable to not join the IDF. It's in the same way, marriage is an institution that's upheld by people, but isn't seen as an institution anymore because it's such an omnipresent factor on our lives. The IDF works very similarly.
And Iowa, you started off introducing yourself saying you're identified as they, them.
Yes.
And so I'm wondering where gender politics fits in your own mind and in your own sort of personal ecosystem into your decision to resist, and how you analyze your position to resist, your decision to resist, based on your own orientation.
Right, so there are multiple parts to this. The first is the gay rights in Israel are at a very, very interesting place where if you agree to go along with the status quo, if you fit in, if you're normal, if you're not going against the dominant ideology, then generally things are, they're not great, but they're pretty good. I think an example of this is, of course, you mentioned a while back about how I made a Facebook post about getting arrested at Tel Aviv Pride for holding a Palestinian flag. And that's, I think, really the dominant idea.
And you did that? You held a Palestinian flag?
Yes, I held a sign with the Palestinian flag on it that said...
Tell me about that.
There's an idea in Israel, especially in among the more liberal areas, in which queer people are a political pawn to justify the occupation and everything Israel does. You know, it's the kind of ideas, oh, you're pro-Palestinian rights? Well, I think that the Palestinians would throw rocks at you, and there you go, you can't be pro-Palestinian rights. You know, the idea that just, like, regardless of if it's true or not, and it's more complicated than that, the idea that just because, like, some people would hate you, you should want to kill them or destroy their lives for, like, different reasons. It's a very omnipresent idea in so much of Israeli political discourse. And so I came with that sign. It said, no pride in the occupation. And I wanted to say...
With a Palestinian flag.
Yes. And I wanted to say, stop...
And this was in Tel Aviv.
Yes. And I wanted to say, stop using me as your goddamn rhetorical puppet. You don't know about me. You don't care about me. And you only want me here as long as I can prove useful to you. And that was obviously the case, because they took me out, arrested me, and spent the entire time misgendering me. So,
they took the entire time gendering you.
Like, they spent the entire time referring to me with the wrong pronouns. In Hebrew, all words are gendered. So, never mind. It's complicated and linguistics. But
you got arrested.
They took me out and read me my rights, and it was very, very stressful. Honestly, I got off very easy because I'm as white as mayonnaise. It's important for me to point out that, like, had I been Palestinian or had I been someone else, it would have ended far less well. I got released after an hour. That's nothing. That's small potatoes. I went back into the parade later to meet my friends. It wasn't that much of a big deal. But
what did your friends say? In the gay pride parade, what did they say?
Well, some of my... It's an interesting position, because some of my friends that were there, as I said earlier, they were, you know, my friends from school, and they were shocked, because, as said before, so much of the dominant political ideology in Israel is just based on denying facts. So when I came and say, I was just fucking arrested, then it's shocking. They don't think of it as the kind of thing that happens in Israel. That's not the thing that happens in the middle of Tel Aviv to white kids they know. That's not supposed to be the case. So for a lot of them, it was pretty, you know, shocking.
And so, I mean, this kind of brings me back to this idea, this question that I had about how you see your own actions tactically or strategically as helping bring about change. Simply by doing what you're doing,
yes.
And that act of carrying a sign that said, you know,
no pride in the occupation,
no pride in the occupation of the Palestinian flag. Well, talk about a teachable moment,
right.
And then you got arrested. Because, that was a teachable moment.
Yeah, I think that's a lot of the idea. A lot of the idea of the Israeli, like, refusenik. I think that's the word that's used in English.
Regardless.
Refuser? Yeah. So,
We also talk about refuseniks.
Really?
Sorry. Yeah, it's actually a Russian term. It's the idea of just weaponizing the military's and the police's action against them. For example, Noam's example of he's going to publicly refuse and get arrested for it for multiple months. That's an exact example, because this is an opportunity in which we are using the violent actions of the police and turning it against them, because it actually looks really bad for the military when they arrest random 18-year-olds and hold them for 4 months. That's like it That's part of the idea. In many ways, getting arrested was very beneficial for the protest because it proves what's happening. It's a direct way of looking at people and saying, this is the world you're living in. This is the country you're living in. And you hold this sign for 5 minutes and you're going to get arrested. And it's a very, very, it's one of our only ways of protesting currently, because we're going to get arrested either way. So we might as well try and use that to our benefit.
But getting back to this question, I was asking you, Ayelet, about, where your own gender orientation and gender politics fits into your decision to resist, or how it informed your decision to resist. And I thought it was very interesting when you said, going into the IDF is as, sacrosanct in Israeli society as it is for a man to marry a woman. Right, to get married and have children, in around the world. That's kind of considered to be so sacrosanct that if you decide to do something different, you're really weird.
Right. In many ways.
So I'm wondering how that fits within your own, has informed your own analysis. Because you yourself, I'm sure, have over the years been growing into and maturing into your own identity, your own personal identity. And at the same time, in parallel, you've been arriving at a political analysis which leads you to resisting. So this is very interesting stuff.
That's true. I think, as said before, it is in fact correct that when you look at certain groups, like our own refusal network and other similar protests, you'll see a lot of things that reflects what you're saying here. When you're already going against such big ideas in our world, such as heteronormativity and cisnormativity, it's easier to make other similar changes, which is why you look at organizations like ours and, for example, Banki, which is an organization that works with us. Banki, they're the communist youth group. And they are, and the people there are, like, there's a very high percentage of trans people and of gay people. And that certainly reflects the idea. But on the other hand, as I also said, for a lot of queer people in Israel, the idea to gain acceptance is to work within the status quo. You can kind of avoid the most unfortunate implications of being so deeply weird as per our society by going really heavy into the military stuff. But I would also like to mention another part of this, which is it is still very expected for me to join the IDF, but it is less so, for example, than someone like Noam. Because the IDF doesn't do this anymore, but it kind of does. It basically automatically releases trans people. So it's, for example, my current plan is to, just like Noam, when I turn 18 and they call me to come, to refuse and do so publicly. But it's possible that before I get the chance to do that, they'll just release me because I'm trans.
And you'll go, darn it.
And I'll go, darn it, you took away my abilities to dramatically refuse calling attention to our cause. So that's an example in which, in a lot of ways, existing in such a way, kind of on the margins of what's, like, in the margins of what's considered acceptable, does inform your decisions and how you do things.
Yeah, like when you're a square peg in a round hole in this situation, you're probably going to be a square peg in a round hole all the time. You know that expression, being a square peg in a...
Yeah.
Noam? Thoughts?
Yeah. All the hierarchical systems in our society are looped into each other. Capitalism, white supremacy, patriarchy, cis heteronormativity, they're all reinforcing each other and building upon each other. So the moment someone is out of one of them, it's much easier to get out of sync with the rest of them. That's why, because there's nothing inherently, in a different world, there would be nothing inherently progressive or leftist or anything like that about being gay. That's a result of us being in a heteronormative system. So the moment that your identity puts you in that position, you're much more likely to go for the rest of those conclusions as well. You're much more likely to start and see the veil lift, you could say. As for Mr. Vought, the organization has existed for how many? Over a decade, right?
Yeah, 20 years or so.
20 years. So it's an organization that specializes in giving financial, legal, and emotional aid to people who are trying to refuse. And we have people like me who come from families where the range of reactions go from support to tacit acceptance, but you also have people whose families are not okay with it, people whose families are actively against them refusing. And Mr. Vought is able to help all of those people while allowing them a space to organize politically.
Noam Aharoni and Ayoet are young Israelis who refuse to serve in the IDF. Noam has just been granted conscientious objector status. Read more about Mr. Vought, the anti-occupation group that's helping them out, at greenplanetmonitor.net. This coming November in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, the international community will take yet another crack and addressing the climate crisis. If the 27th conference of the parties to the UN Climate Change Convention is anything like COP26 in Glasgow, it will be a bust. The fossil fuel industry will be out in force, as it always is, lobbying for oil, gas, and coal. As industry and world leaders cop out once again, others dig for solutions where solutions count the most. Cities consume almost 80% of global energy resources and generate 60% of earth-warming emissions. Urban buildings account for a third of energy consumption and 40% of emissions. Here's a story from the Swedish city of Göteborg about a living lab for carbon neutrality. It's Saturday here in Göteborg, Sweden. In a four-story building on the campus of Chalmers University of Technology, a student named Stig Robertson has washed his bedsheets and is now drying them in a curious apparatus.
So right now I'm doing my laundry. I'm just cleaning my bedsheets.
And you're hanging them up in this chamber.
Yeah.
What is this thing?
Oh, this is a drying chamber. In Sweden, it's quite common, instead of just using the... You dry your clothes in, usually you just hang them in a big chamber and you dry them.
Stig Robertson may just be drying his bedsheets at low energy cost, but he's part of a big experiment aimed at designing buildings for a low carbon future. Stig does pay rent to live here, but he's also agreed to be monitored.
Part of the experiment is that we don't really think about being in an experiment all the time, right? In that sense, it's working.
I spent a weekend here at the Living Lab. 40 students and researchers call it home. Their mission? To test and demonstrate housing technologies of the future. 2,000 sensors monitor energy and water use, air quality, and moisture. Pipes, meters, and electronic gizmos are tucked away in corners and behind glass, easy to maintain, replace, and watch. The Living Lab is owned and operated by HSB, Sweden's largest cooperative housing corporation and innovator.
Hi there, I'm Madeline. I was just up checking the apartment that you're going to stay in.
Madeline Dufrix manages the Living Lab. I spent a weekend here cooking my meals, washing up, and fully monitored. Madeline takes me on a tour. We visit the energy hub, where geothermal heat and hot water flow. Outside, we step into one of the Living Lab's most congenial facilities.
This is the sound of birds that starts when you open the door to the garbage room.
The Living Lab's garbage room sounds great and is a sight for sore eyes. Images of a green forest adorn the walls behind multicolored trash bins. There's even one for electronic waste. Inside each, a sensor sends a message when the bin is full. Why waste energy picking up a trash bin that's half full? Sweden generates 45% of its electricity from hydropower, 45% from nuclear, and that last 10% from wind and solar. Living Lab researchers wants to optimize that renewable slice. A clothes dryer can be set to eco, lowering the dryer's CO2 emissions. Outside, an electric car charger kicks in when solar batteries are fully charged with the tap of a smartphone. Still, in a low-carbon world, power supply may be less dependable, and people will have to cope.
People are quite worried that they won't be able to use their phones or their laptops.
Helena Strumbach is a Living Lab researcher. She challenged residents to cook together using an energy-resilient meal kit.
We have at least 10 people signed up already who will use our recipes, scenarios, and groceries to cook. To prepare food when you have electricity, but if you have an outage at mealtime, it will still be a good meal. Other forms of cooking that do not rely on electricity, like maybe pickling or fermenting, to still create that feeling of a cooked meal, but without the heat of electricity.
If cooking in the dark flummoxed some, showering in their neighbor's water was downright icky. Shower and kitchen gray water at the Living Lab are recycled.
A large concern for people using recycled water is that, oh, I don't want to use water that people maybe have peed in or...
Swedish entrepreneur Per Eriksson designs the system. Shower and sink water are captured, filtered, and sent back upstairs along with their heat. Polluted water goes down the drain. Per shows me his gray water recycling system. At its core, a filter that removes everything, down to the tiniest bacteria and viruses. So, recycled shower water at the Living Lab is actually cleaner than tap water, and heating costs are cut in half.
When people actually understand this, that you're saving maybe over 50% of the energy and 60% of the water in a building, the coin drops. You can see it in their eyes. You go, damn. You know, why haven't we done this before? This is so logical.
Then there's the logic of molecular solar windows, not yet in use at the Living Lab, but possibly coming soon. In a couple of organic chemistry labs across campus from the Living Lab, Kasper Mott-Poulsen is cooking up a molecular photo switch, a tiny molecule that absorbs sunlight, shape-shifts to a higher energy state, then returns to ground state, releasing heat.
So the basic idea of this is that we want to get away from burning things to get the chemical energy out, but instead creating a reusable system where we shine light on it, store the energy, and then release the heat when we need it.
Norbornadiene, the molecule is called. Kasper and his colleagues are designing the molecule to absorb as much sunlight as possible, hold that energy, and then release it on demand. Eventually, norbornadiene-coated windows will capture sunlight in the day and release heat indoors at night.
So now we are entering the chemistry lab.
Kasper takes me to two labs. The first one is traditional. In the second one, norbornadiene is cooked up by computer. Dozens of versions of the light-absorbing molecule are synthesized in search of the optimum photo switch. Perfected and scaled up, Kasper's little molecule stands to revolutionize window design. And other technologies showcased at the Living Lab may soon be standard in cities, buildings, and households around the world. Hanging his bed sheets to dry in the Swedish drying chamber, Stig Robertson is happy to be part of the project.
Living Lab is an interesting way to research new ways of living, maybe more effective ways of living, resource-effective way of living for the future.
Read more about the HSB Living Lab at greenplanetmonitor.net. That's it for today's edition of the Green Planet Monitor, coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions, Breda, in the Netherlands. Listen, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. I'm David Kattenberg, over and out for now.